The boy lay on a hard bed in a narrow room, a cold towel folded across his forehead. Tweetle and Cutangle watched him carefully.
"How long has it been?" said Cutangle.
Tweetle shrugged.
3 days.
"And he hasn't come around once?"
"No."
Cutangle sat down heavily on the edge of the bed and pinched the bridge of his nose wearily. Simon had never looked particularly healthy, but now his face had a horrible sunken look.
"A brilliant mind, that one," he said. "His explanation of the fundamental principles of magic and matter. Quite astounding."
Tweetle nodded.
"The way he just absorbs knowledge," said Cutangle. "I've been a working wizard all my life, and somehow I never really understood magic until he explained it. So clear. So, well, obvious."
"Everyone says that," said Tweetle gloomily.
"They say it's like having a hoodwink pulled off and seeing the daylight for the first time." "That's exactly it," said Cutangle. "He's sorcerer material, sure enough. You were right to bring him here."
There was a thoughtful pause.
"Only?"
said Tweetle.
"Only what?"
asked Cutangle.
"Only what was it you understood?"
said Tweetle.
"That's what's bothering me. I mean, can you explain it?"
"How do you mean, explain?"
Cutangle looked worried.
"What he keeps talking about,"
said Trestle, a hint of desperation in his voice.
"Oh, is the genuine stuff, I know, but what exactly is it?"
Cutangle looked at him, his mouth open. Eventually, he said,
"Oh, that's easy. Magic fills the universe, you see, and every time the universe changes... No, I mean, every time magic is invoked, the universe changes, only in every direction at once. Do you see? And..."
He moved his hands uncertainly, trying to recognise a spark of comprehension in Tweetle's face.
"To put it another way, any piece of matter, like an orange or the world or...
"A crocodile?"
suggested Tweetle.
"Yes, a crocodile or... whatever, is basically shaped like a carrot."
"I don't remember that bit," said Tweetle.
"I'm sure that's what he said,"
said Cutangle. He was starting to sweat.
"No, I remember the bit where he seemed to suggest that if you went far enough in any direction, you would see the back of your head,"
Tweetle insisted.
"You're sure he didn't mean someone else's head?"
Tweetle thought for a bit.
"No, I'm pretty sure he said the back of your own head," he said. "I think he said he could prove it."
They considered this in silence. Finally, Cutangle spoke very slowly and carefully.
"I look at it like this," he said. "Before I heard him talk, I was like everyone else. You know what I mean? I was confused and uncertain about all the little details of life. But now," he brightened up, "while I'm still confused and uncertain, it's on a much higher plane, do you see? And at least I know I'm bewildered about the really fundamental and important facts of the universe."
Tweetle nodded.
"I hadn't looked at it like that," he said. "But you're absolutely right. He's really pushed back the boundaries of ignorance. There's so much about the universe we don't know."
They both savoured the strange, warm glow of being much more ignorant than ordinary people, who were ignorant of only ordinary things. Then Tweetle said,
"I just hope he's all right. He's over the fever, but he just doesn't seem to want to wake up."
A couple of servants came in with a bowl of water and fresh towels. One of them carried a rather tatty broomstick. As they began to change the sweat-soaked sheets under the boy, the two wizards left, still discussing the vast vistas of unknowingness that Simon's genius had revealed to the world. Granny waited until their footsteps had died away and took off her headscarf.
"Damn thing," she said. "Esk, go and listen at the door."
She removed the towel from Simon's head and felt his temperature.
"It was very good of you to come," said Esk. "And you so busy with your work and everything."
Granny pursed her lips. She pulled up Simon's eyelids and sought his pulse.
She laid an ear on his xylophone chest and listened to his heart. She sat for some time quite motionless, probing around inside his head. She frowned.
"Is he all right?" said Esk anxiously.
Granny looked at the stone walls.
"Drat this place," she said. "It's no place for sick people."
"Yes, but is he all right?"
"What?"
Granny was startled out of her thoughts. "Oh, yes, probably, wherever he is." Esk stared at her, and then at Simon's body.
"Nobody's home," said Granny simply.
"What do you mean?"
"Listen to the child," said Granny. "You'd think I taught her nothing. I mean, his mind's wandering. He's gone out of his head."
She looked at Simon's body with something verging on admiration.
"Quite surprising, really," she added. "I never yet met a wizard who could borrow."
She turned to Esk, whose mouth was a horrified O.
"I remember when I was a girl, old Nanny Annapol went wandering. Got too wrapped up with being a vixen, as I recall.
Took us days to find her.
And then there was you, too. I never would have found you if it wasn't for that staff thing. And
what have you done with it, girl?"
"It hit him," Esk muttered. "It tried to kill him. I threw it in the river."
"Not a nice thing to do to it after it saved you," said Granny.
"It saved me by hitting him? Didn't you realise he was calling to them things? That's not true."
Granny stared into Esk's defiant eyes, and the thought came to her mind, "I've lost her. All that work down the privy." She couldn't be a wizard, but she might have been a witch.
"Why isn't it true, Miss Clever?" she said. "He wouldn't do something like that."
Esk was near to tears.
"I heard him speak. He's not evil. He's a brilliant person. He nearly understands how everything works.
I expect he's a very nice boy," said Granny sourly. "I never said he was a black wizard, did I?"
"They're horrible things," Esk sobbed. "He wouldn't call out to them. He wants everything that they're not, and you're a wicked old—"
The slap rang like a bell. Esk staggered back, white with shock. Granny stood with her hand upraised, trembling. She'd struck Esk once before, the blow a baby gets to introduce it to the world and give it a rough idea what to expect from life. But that had been the last time. In 12 months under the same roof, there had been calls enough, when milk had been left to boil over or the goats had been carelessly left without water. But a sharp word or a sharper silence had done more than force ever could and left no bruises. She grabbed Esk firmly by the shoulders and stared into her eyes.
"Listen to me," she said urgently. "Didn't I always say to you that if you use magic you should go through the world like a knife goes through water? Didn't I say that?"
Esk, mesmerised like a cornered rabbit, nodded.
"And you thought that was just old Granny's way, didn't you? But the fact is that if you use magic, you draw attention to yourself. From them. They watch the world all the time. Ordinary minds are just vague to them. They hardly bother with them. But a mind with magic in it shines out, you see. It's a beacon to them. It's not darkness that calls them. It's a light. Light that creates the shadows."
But why are they interested? What do they want?"
"Life and shape," said Granny.
She sagged and let go of Esk. "They're pathetic, really," she said. "They've got no life or shape themselves but what they can steal.
They could no more survive in this world than a fish could live in a fire, but that doesn't stop them trying. And they're just bright enough to hate us because we're alive."
Esk shivered. She remembered the gritty feel of the cold sand.
"What are they?
I always thought they were just a sort of demon."
"Nah. No one really knows. They're just the things from the dungeon dimensions outside the universe, that's all. Shadow creatures."
She turned back to the prone form of Simon.
"You wouldn't have any idea where he is, would you?"
she said, looking shrewdly at Esk. Not gone off flying with the seagulls, has he? Esk shook her head. No, said Granny. I didn't think so. They've got him, haven't they?
It wasn't a question. Esk nodded, her face a mask of misery.
It's not your fault, said Granny.
His mind gave them an opening, and when he was knocked out, they took it back with them. Only...
She drummed her fingers on the edge of the bed and appeared to reach a decision. Who's the most important wizard around here? She demanded.
Lord Cutangle, said Esk. He's the Arch-Chancellor. He was one of the ones who was in here.
The fat one, or the one like a streak of vinegar?
Esk dragged her mind from the image of Simon on the cold desert and found herself saying, He's an 8th-level wizard and a 33-degree mage, actually.
You mean he's bent? Said Granny. All this hanging around wizards has made you take them seriously, my girl. They all call themselves the Lord High this and the Imperial that. It's all part of the game. Even magicians do it. You'd think they'd be more sensible at least, but no. They'd call around saying they're the amazing Bonko and Doris. Anyway, where is this high rum tiddly po?
They'll be at dinner in the Great Hall, said Esk. Can he bring Simon back then?
That's the difficult part, said Granny. I dare say we could all get something back easily enough, walking and talking just like anyone. Whether it would be Simon is quite another sack of ferrets.
She stood up.
Let's find this Great Hall, then. No time to waste.
Women aren't allowed in, said Esk.
Granny stopped in the doorway. Her shoulders rose. She turned around very slowly.
What did you say? She said. Did these old ears deceive me? And don't say they did because they didn't.
Sorry, said Esk. Force of habit.
I can see you've been getting ideas below your station, said Granny coldly. Go and find someone to watch over the lad, and let's see what's so great about this hall that I mustn't set foot in it.
And thus it was that while the entire faculty of Unseen University were dining in the venerable hall, the doors were flung back with a dramatic effect that was rather spoiled when one of them rebounded off a waiter and caught Granny a crack on the shin. Instead of the defiant strides she had intended to make across the checkered floor, she was forced to half-hop, half-limp. But she hoped that she hopped with dignity. Esk hurried along behind her, acutely aware of the hundreds of eyes that were turned towards them. The roar of conversation and the clatter of cutlery faded away. A couple of chairs were knocked over. At the far end of the hall, she could see the most senior wizards at their high table, which in fact bobbed a few feet off the floor. They were staring. A medium-grade wizard, Esk recognised him as a lecturer in applied astrology, rushed towards them, waving his hands.
No, 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 he shouted. Wrong door, you must go away.
Don't mind me, said Granny calmly, pushing past him.
No, 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 it's against the law. You must go away now. Ladies are not allowed in here.
I'm not a lady, I'm a witch, said Granny.
She turned to Esk.
Is he very important?
I don't think so, said Esk.
Right, Granny turned to the lecturer. Go and find me an important wizard, please, quickly.
Esk tapped her on the back. A couple of wizards with a rather greater presence of mind had nipped smartly out of the door behind them, and now several college porters were advancing threateningly up the hall to the cheers and catcalls of the students. Esk had never much liked the porters, who lived a private life in their lodge, but now she felt a pang of sympathy for them. Two of them reached out hairy hands and grabbed Granny's shoulders. Her arm disappeared behind her back, and there was a brief flurry of movement that ended with the men hopping away, clutching bits of themselves and swearing.
Hat pin, said Granny.
She grabbed Esk with her free hand and swept towards the high table, glaring at anyone who so much as looked as if they were going to get in her way. The younger students, who knew free entertainment when they saw it, stamped and cheered and banged their plates on the long tables. The high table settled on the tiles with a thump, and the senior wizards hurriedly lined up behind Cutangle as he tried to summon up his reserves of dignity. His efforts didn't really work. It is very hard to look dignified with a napkin tucked into one's collar. He raised his hands for silence, and the hall waited expectantly as Granny and Esk approached him. Granny was looking interestedly at the ancient paintings and statues of bygone mages.
"Who are them buggers?" she said out of the corner of her mouth.
"They used to be chief wizards," whispered Esk.
"They look constipated. I never met a wizard who was regular," said Granny.
"They're a nuisance to dust, that's all I know," said Esk.
Cutangle stood with legs planted wide apart, arms akimbo and stomach giving an impression of a beginner's ski slope, the whole of him therefore adopting a pose usually associated with Henry VIII, but with an option on Henry IX and X as well.
"Well," he said, "what is the meaning of this outrage?"
"Is he important?" said Granny to Esk.
"I, madam, am the Arch-Chancellor, and I happen to run this university, and you, madam, are trespassing in very dangerous territory indeed. I warn you that—" "Stop looking at me like that!"
Cutangle staggered backwards, his hands raised to ward off Granny's gaze. The wizards behind him scattered, turning over tables in their haste to avoid the stare. Granny's eyes had changed. Esk had never seen them like this before. They were perfectly silver, like little round mirrors, reflecting all they saw. Cutangle was a vanishingly small dot in their depths, his mouth open, his tiny matchstick arms waving in desperation. The Arch-Chancellor backed into a pillar, and the shock made him recover. He shook his head irritably, cupped a hand, and sent a stream of white fire streaking towards the witch. Without dropping her iridescent stare, Granny raised a hand and deflected the flames towards the roof. There was an explosion and a shower of tile fragments. Her eyes widened. Cutangle vanished. Where he had been standing, a huge snake coiled, poised to strike. Granny vanished. Where she had been standing was a large wicker basket. The snake became a giant reptile from the mists of time. The basket became the snow wind of the ice giants, coating the struggling monster with ice. The reptile became a saber-toothed tiger crouched to spring. The gale became a bubbling tar pit. The tiger managed to become an eagle, stooping. The tar pits became a tufted hood. Then the images began to flicker as shape replaced shape. Stroboscope shadows danced around the hall. A magical wind sprang up, thick and greasy, striking octarine sparks from beards and fingers. In the middle of it all, Esk, peering through streaming eyes, could just make out the two figures of Granny and Cutangle, glossy statues in the midst of the hurtling images. She was also aware of something else, a high-pitched sound almost beyond hearing. She had heard it before, on the cold plain. A busy, chittering noise. A beehive noise. An anthill sound.
"They're coming!"
she screamed above the din. "They're coming now!" She scrambled out from behind the table where she had taken refuge from the magical duel and tried to reach Granny. A gust of raw magic lifted her off her feet and bowled her into a chair. The buzzing was louder now, so that the air roared like a three-week corpse on a summer's day. Esk made another attempt to reach Granny and recoiled when green fire roared along her arm and singed her hair. She looked around wildly for the other wizards, but those who had fled from the effects of the magic were cowering behind overturned furniture while the occult storm raged over their heads. Esk ran down the length of the hall and out into the dark corridor. Shadows curled around her as she hurried, sobbing, up the steps and along the buzzing corridors towards Simon's narrow room. "Something would try to enter the body," Granny had said. "Something that would walk and talk like Simon, but would be something else." A cluster of students were hovering anxiously outside the door. They turned pale faces towards Esk as she darted towards them and were sufficiently shaken to draw back nervously in the face of her determined progress.
Something's in there, said one of them.
We can't open the door.
They looked at her expectantly. Then one of them said, You wouldn't have a pass key by any chance.
Esk grabbed the door handle and turned it. It moved slightly, but then spun back with such force it nearly took the skin off her hands. The chittering inside rose to a crescendo, and there was another noise too, like leather flapping.
You're wizards, she screamed. Bloody well whiz!
We haven't done telekinesis yet, said one of them. I was ill when we did fire throwing. Actually, I'm not very good at dematerialisation.
Esk went to the door and then stopped with one foot in the air. She remembered Granny talking about how even buildings had a mind if they were old enough. The university was very old. She stepped carefully to one side and ran her hands over the ancient stones. It had to be done carefully so as not to frighten it. And now she could feel the mind in the stones, slow and simple, but still mind. It pulsed around her. She could feel the little sparkles deep in the rock. Something was hooting behind the door. The three students watched in astonishment as Esk stood rock still with her hands and forehead pressed against the wall. She was almost there. She could feel the weight of herself, the ponderousness of her body, the distant memories of the dawn of time when rock was molten and free. For the first time in her life, she knew what it was like to have balconies. She moved gently through the building mind, refining her impressions, looking as fast as she dared for this corridor, this door. She stretched out one arm very carefully. The students watched as she uncurled one finger very slowly. The door hinges began to creak. There was a moment of tension, and then the nails sprang from the hinges and clattered into the wall behind her. The planks began to bend as the door still tried to force itself open against the strength of whatever was holding it shut. The wood billowed. Beams of blue light lanced out into the corridor, moving and dancing as indistinct shapes shuffled through the blinding brilliance inside the room. The light was misty and actinic, the sort of light to make Steven Spielberg reach for his copyright lawyer. Esk's hair leapt from her head so that she looked like an ambulant dandelion. Little fire snakes of magic crackled across her skin as she stepped through the doorway. The students outside watched in horror as she disappeared into the light. It vanished in a silent explosion. When they eventually found enough courage to look inside the room, they saw nothing there but the sleeping body of Simon, and Esk, silent and cold on the floor, breathing very slowly. And the floor was covered with a fine layer of silver sand.